A while back, we had the pleasure of visiting with Ellie Kastner from W.H. Kastner Metal Fabricators. And during the break, Ellie and I got into a conversation on some very interesting topics, coming from the standpoint of both being females and CEOs of companies that are in what is considered a male-dominated industry, and went into some very interesting, I think, subject matter and some tips that she shared with me in business that I think would be helpful to a number of business owners in our wastewater industry, especially in the contracting arena. And so with that said, here is the continuation of that conversation. Because what you, the unsung heroes in the wastewater industry, do matters. Every Wednesday, join me, Suzanne Chin Taylor, the Doo-Doo Diva, a longtime veteran of the wastewater, trenchless, and civil infrastructure industry, as I interview guests who are making an impact on how we manage and operate systems for conveying and treating wastewater. I'll also be speaking with representatives of organizations that are utilizing disruptive or new technologies, and executives who are going to share how to be successful and sustainable in our vital industry. So whether you want to learn about the latest trends in technology in treatment or trenchless, gain tips on training and retaining great talent, or simply how to be more efficient, productive, or profitable, this podcast is for you. Well, hello, and welcome to this week's episode of the Doo-Doo Divas Smells Like Money podcast. I have the pleasure to be visiting yet again and continuing with Ellie Kastner of W.H. Kastner Metal Fabricators. Today, we're going to be discussing a topic that is kind of near and dear to my heart as a woman-owned business owner and also a minority business owner. And we're going to be talking about how you can use those distinctions to your advantage to win more business. So, Ellie, thank you for being on the show and sharing with us your great depth of knowledge on this particular subject.
Thanks for having me again.
So, Ellie, please share with me, because I think it's really fascinating for our audience to hear about this, because you don't hear about it much these days, the history of your business and all of the generations, because I just found it fascinating.
Yeah, so in 1961, my grandfather, Wolfgang Hugo Kastner, incorporated W.H. Kastner Incorporated. My dad likes to say it stands for World Headquarters, but it really stands for Wolfgang Hugo. And this was after he graduated from Cooper Union in New York City after fleeing Germany in World War II. So he has a really amazing history that is full with sort of those charismatic bobs and weaves and close calls, but he was settling down by the time he started the company. And I think actually when he incorporated the company, he didn't quite know how he was going to use his skills. He had been working as a traveling sales representative for a architectural railing components company. So you would order from the catalog, and frankly, we still order from that company sometimes. It's really high quality, great stuff. But every application, you know, you would order a railing that's supposed to be 4 feet, but inevitably in the real world, it needed to be modified. So slowly but surely, they started up a shop in Suffern, New York, which is about an hour outside of New York City. And my father came on when he graduated from college, and they just started ramping up operations. And from the early days, I think it was a little Wild West. I think they would take on a job and shake hands and present themselves and then come back to the shop and be like, how do we do this? But it was something that they learned over time and eventually moved into a much larger shop facility, which still by the scale of things is a small family run shop, but we still are in that location in Tompkins Cove, New York, and which is similarly about an hour outside New York City, but a little bit further north. we're right on the Hudson River. It's a really beautiful place to work. Mm-hmm. And in the early days, my father and grandfather really worked in the wastewater treatment plant and water treatment plant industry. In the 80s and 90s, my father and his brother-in-law, so Eric Kasner and Tom Petro, worked mainly in pharmaceutical industry applications. So a lot of R&D facilities, a lot of high-end stainless steel work. And then when I took over the business in 2013, with my brother, so we're the third generation business owners, we transitioned back to the water treatment plant and wastewater treatment plant industries, as well as some other public works projects, but that's the vast majority of our work.
So what made you and the company decide to go for transition to become a women business enterprise? What drove that decision?
So when we first took over the business, we were still firmly planted in the pharmaceutical industry. However, in our area, I don't know if the news was the same across the nation the way it came out in the New York metropolitan area, but basically the Pfizers, the Novartis, the Bristol-Myers Squibb, I mean, all of the large pharmaceutical industry in the 2010s started moving overseas for tax shelters. So all of the work that had been happening in our area was really coming to a close. Those large campus facilities that required that servicing were moving away. So as we took over the business, that wasn't going to be a sustainable model. The wastewater treatment plant and water treatment plant industry is an amazing place for a miscellaneous metal contract. Basically, everything is function over fashion. It's you want the best work, not the cheapest work. You want somebody who understands, and everything basically is customized. So it's not really the right application for large CNC or large structural contractors, unless it is a really, really large plant. But most of your mid-sized plants really need a strong miscellaneous metal subcontractor. It helps the project greatly. So that's why we decided to go back to that industry. And of course, it was our roots. And then as we bought out the business from the last generation owners as part of the succession plan, we decided to become a woman-owned business because not only did it match our talents and the types of work that were suited to both my brother and I, filling the needs of the business, but also it holds a lot of benefits once you're filed as an appropriate woman-owned business with the state or federal government or third-party certifier. And it is legitimately what we are, but it certainly has its advantages too.
How long did that process take you to become certified?
So you'd think that you would take over the business and then I'm a woman and now I'm a woman-owned business. That is true, but for all of us who have already been through the certification process, we know it takes a lot longer than that. And for anyone listening who is considering this, it does take longer than that. So essentially, companies that want to go for that type of certification, there's a lot of paperwork that needs to be filed. Again, it depends whether you're going for a third-party certification, which is mainly for like Fortune 500 companies. They're not required to involve themselves with supplier diversity initiatives, but it looks good for them. So they want that background. And then for us working in the public sector, we have either municipalities, so New York City, we have the state, New York State, and then we have a federal certification that is actually run through the New York State Department of Transportation, but that's called a disadvantaged business enterprise certification. So I think our New York City and New York State applications took about a year, and I think now they're fast tracked together. Then we got our certification for New Jersey State because we do a bunch of work in New Jersey. And then our DBE application, which was granted through the Metropolitan Transit Authority, the MTA of New York City. That took about a year too.
So it is a timely process, but from what you were sharing with me in our conversation, it was well worth going through the exercise, for lack of a better term. And that what I'd like for you to share with the audience, since you got this, is that how have you used it to your advantage? And you mentioned a term just a few minutes ago, diversity. What was that?
Supplier diversity.
Can you go into some detail and explain that to me on how that works and how contractors can use that requirement to their advantage, like you have?
Yeah. So supplier diversity is relating to having suppliers that are not the traditional suppliers. So in construction, that really is all male run businesses. And it is put in place mainly to try to increase opportunities for different people. So again, in a sector where it's not required, it can just be a company that is aligning their corporate culture or their goals for how they want to appear to the world. For state-run projects or projects that are getting federal funding, those are kind of the strings attached, at least some of them. So they'll have goals on projects that are 10% woman-owned business goals or 13% minority-owned business goals. They need to then, when they bid, include a utilization plan that illustrates how they're going to make that happen. So at bid time, they are often including my bid number as a subcontractor to the owner, and they're saying, this is how we plan to meet that 10%. Now, this requirement has been around for a long time, but it just has been sort of starting to be enforced over the past 10 years. And these goals, if you don't meet them, you don't get the contract often. It's a serious penalty. If you say you're going to meet them and then you don't, you kind of get a black mark against your name as a general contractor as you go for a next project. It'll follow you around. So it's something that used to be sort of just brushed under the rug, and now there's no way to get around it. So with my company, it's really been that it's helped us get our foot in the door. When we see a general contractor that we want to work with, we put forth our best bid, we sharpen our pencil, we do all the homework just like everyone else. But then we also have this certification that gives them sort of an incentive to give us a chance. Then we do repeat work because they like our work, but we help them meet their goals. A big piece of that that's also helped us is that, A, when they go in at bid time with our number, we have not found people come back to us to negotiate because they already included our numbers. So we don't have to lower our number later.
Okay.
And we've also found, and that's sort of internal business to business, since I'm a second tier sub, that's not with the owner, that's with the general contractor, of course. The other thing that we've noticed is that we had a project where we were having trouble getting paid, even though it was a public works project. I think any business owner has sort of been there. We had extra avenues to pursue getting paid, and we got paid dollar for dollar what we were supposed to, when I know many other subs on that project took 50% payouts.
How did that work? Well, unless it's going to be
generally, it's like, you know, when you make the decision to call somebody's boss, it's like that.
Got it. Okay. That, hey, you know, business is business. You know, sometimes
you have to do what you have to do so that you're not taken advantage of. You know, none of us as business owners should work for free or work for less than what our true value is.
But because we were the WBE on the project and they were claiming our credit as part of their goal, from the beginning, we were a more visible subcontractor. And if they don't meet that requirement by paying what they were supposed to, that yields further problems for them. So that was a different leverage that we had. It's kind of a benefit to the certification that you hope you never have to use, but it's something that we have used and it was a big deal for our small business.
Wow. Little known back channel things, you know, it's important to read the fine print, right? So you had mentioned, you had mentioned something to me about or how some things came about. I took some notes here. I've got it on my other screen about that there are these inspection checks for fraud that they've really put into place to eliminate something where it has to be competitive so that things aren't quote unquote stacked in favor bidding or, oh yeah, he's been doing the work for 25 years. We're just going to give it to him because we know him. And that those rules are not applying anymore so that people can, other people coming onto the playing field can actually have a fair chance at winning.
Yeah. So again, when it comes to a bid that's just open to primes,
right,
it's the lowest bid. Now we can talk to about for days about what that should really be. Should it really be throw out the lowest, throw out the highest, and go to the middle of the pack and pick the second? Should it be if all the bids are close together that you take the lowest? I mean, there's some reasons of why the lowest bid isn't always the best bid. We've all been on a project or two like that and learned our lesson. But it's more of the accountability for those second tier subs. And that's the perspective that I'm coming from. So the goals set by the state or the federal government or whoever is setting the public works goals, that's what in sort of encourages the chance to go out there and use someone else with a minority owned business or woman owned business certification. So that's kind of the incentive. But on larger projects, it tends to be on larger projects, I've noticed, I have had many interviews that are called commercially useful function interviews. And the interviewer will come to my business and I give them a tour and I sort of show them around because they're, even though I'm the business owner, even though I have been certified by the state, by the federal government, by New York City, even though there's interviews and I've done all the work, they're still there to check to make sure that I am at the helm of my company and that I'm there every day. Instead of a version of this where if a man is running the company and then they just put the company in their wife's name, something like that.
Okay. To really make sure that this is what they say it is.
Which I don't begrudge in one way, but in another way, it's another burden of proof as a woman business owner that kind of suggests, could you really be doing this? And that's, it's disappointing. And I'm not against it at all. Again, these are the costs of doing business.
Right.
It's no problem for me to show you around my office, come by, but still, it's an interesting piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, and I think it is. It's that as more of us are willing to enter those fields that have been traditionally thought of as, or we were maybe told, I remember being told by mother, oh no, that's not a job for a girl. That's only a job for a boy. And I was always one to stomp my feet against the double standard and go, why? And then she could never really give me a straight answer. And so I'd keep pushing for the, when you give me a good reason why, then I'll drop the subject. And most times we couldn't get the answer. Like, I want a train set for Christmas, and I'd get a doll. And it's like, the next year would come, and I would ask for the train set again. And it was like, finally, I tell people the story, it's just, finally on my 21st Christmas, 21 years old, because I'm born 4 days before Christmas, on my 21st Christmas, underneath the tree, my mother finally bought me an electric train set.
Wow.
And I had a blast.
It took time for change, but she did it. Good for her.
She finally did it. It took a while, took a long while, longer than I would have liked, but you know, hey, better late than never. So yeah, it's really cool to hear that, because I do know that that process of getting certified, that I've talked to a lot of women business owners that start going through that process, and because there's so much paperwork, they quit halfway through because they're like, I don't have time for this. And so it's really good to hear from someone that's doing this in our industry to say, see it the whole way through, because obviously it does pay off.
I think just that's really good. Yeah, I think that's really good advice. And there is an element of perseverance. It can be frustrating, but I would also say that when we first got our certifications, at first, I didn't really see it working for us. And I was very frustrated. I was attending the events. I was doing the certification. I was getting myself out there. My marketing material was impeccable. You know, I was honing in on my own presentation, my own conversations. We were winning bids. We know where our numbers were right. You know, I was starting to wonder, why is this not working? And just let me tell you, when it rained, it poured. Really one of the first contracts that I got from my WBE certification was the Tappan Zee Bridge project, which was the largest project in the country for $4 billion at the time. We were a very small piece of that project. We were doing the permanent maintenance facility and then later the state police facility on the east side of the Hudson River. But that was the first. And within 2 weeks, there was another contract. And within 2 weeks, there was a different contract, all pretty much attributable to my WBE certifications. And now I would say about 85% plus of our contracts are utilizing our WBE certifications. Now that's specifically within the public works construction industry. So I don't mean, some women-owned businesses can make the assessment that it's not worth it for them in their industries. That totally makes sense, but you owe it to yourself to consider it.
I have to ask, was it just that one project you think that was the tipping point that started the effect? Or do you think there was something else that kind of set the whole thing in motion?
I had really been hitting the streets like a lot. So I was in the spaces. The contracts that we won right after the Tappan Zee Bridge project, they didn't know we were on the Tappan Zee Bridge project. So I don't think that it was that, although that is a name maker project. Later, I think that it's a huge feather in our cap, if you will, because then any other facility or general contractor knows that we can handle that level of administration, that level of oversight, that quality control process. No project we ever do again will be held to those standards. It was really, really a difficult client, a notoriously difficult client. Everyone knew it at every single step of the job. Now it's an exceptional masterpiece project. So we understand why it was that way, but it makes it so any other thing we approach, we're ready for it. And so I do think that it has some piece in the puzzle or of our trajectory, of our narrative arc, of our future and present as a company. But I don't think it's only because of one project, because just like anyone, one project for a company that's been around for 60 years is one project. And we want to be around for a lot longer than that.
Your legacy, you know, perhaps for the next generation of Kastners. And, you know, it's, you stayed the course. A lot of people have a tendency to give up too early in their marketing and their sales when you were saying you were hitting the streets. And I always advise folks, winning the day, it's not a sprint, it's a marathon. You know, so slow and steady and stay focused. Not that you don't have to pivot and shift sometimes, but as long as you keep at it, it will happen. It will happen. I love how that, you know, you just decided to, you saw the writing on the wall with the pharmaceutical things and decided, wait a minute, maybe we need to go back to our roots instead of being so, you know, tightly married to, well, you know, dad and granddad did this, and dad and brother-in-law or uncle did this, that it's okay and it's time to make that shift. And sometimes change can be uncomfortable, but in your case, that change really paid off.
Well, it was necessary. We didn't, you know, ultimately we could have gone down with a, you know, sinking ship, but the point being that, yeah, there was some writing on the wall. One of the years I'm most proud of our work is around, I think it was 2015, we had a break-even year. But that was after 2 years of positioning ourselves to be taking on more wastewater treatment plant work and getting out of the pharma industry, because I know many businesses that I worked with on a daily basis that went out of business that year. So I didn't even lose money. I just broke even, and they just weren't ready to change. They weren't at their company's point in life. They were more of my father and uncle's generation, and they didn't really want to change, and they saw it coming too. I don't mean to undermine their business acumen. They chose basically retirement in a way, but we did not want to do that because we were in our succession plan for the next generation. And I would still love to work in pharma if it was there. I think it's a great industry, but it's just not there. They're also very demanding clients, and they have a right to be because they're making the drugs that save our lives. So if something, they don't like something on a Saturday, you know, you're there on a Saturday. If they don't like something in one room that's always working all the time, then you're there on a holiday shutdown. So there's pros and cons of it, but I'm glad that we saw it and we were willing to take the jump. And ultimately, at least 90% of our current clients since 2013 are clients that I myself and my brother have developed and that were not existing clients of WH Kasner's before. So that's important because it speaks to the sustainability of the company. I didn't inherit all of these clients. We created our own thing. And that to me shows that the business has a future, not just a past.
Oh, I love that. Well, Ellie, I want to thank you for staying on and continuing this conversation about this subject, because it is, you know, contracting, and you've kind of demystified it on how people can tap that little, I think it's kind of an unknown treasure trove of business and a way to really grow your business if you fall into that category. And there's enough of us out there, you know, women owned as well as minority, that could and can and should take advantage of these opportunities that are available. So again, thank you. For those of you who are interested in learning more about Ellie and her company and the incredible products and services they offer, you can find more about them online at whkasner.com. And again, thank you and best of luck in your future endeavors, and you know, keep winning those bids and women power. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining me, the Doo-Doo Diva, on this week's episode of Smells Like Money. Be sure to subscribe to the show so you'll never miss an episode. And while you're at it, if you found value in this show, we'd appreciate a rating on iTunes, or simply tell a friend about the show, because that would help us out a lot too. If you're an industry expert and would like to be considered as a guest for the show, email guest@smellslikemoneymedia.com. Tell us a little bit about yourself and the topics you'd like to talk about, and we'll be in touch. For more information about our family of marketing, international business development, and workforce training companies dedicated to the empowerment and education of our industry, call us at 760-217-8010 or email me at raven@creativeraven.com. Until next week, a big shout out to all my industry friends and those who will be. You're my superheroes.